The hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
The coronavirus health crisis has had an unexpected effect on an event that happens once every 10 years in the United States. The U.S. Census. For example, Betsy Landon was listed by her parents on the 2020 census as living at her family's home in Phoenix, Arizona. But experts say she should have been counted in the city of Tempe, where she goes to school. We really didn't have any instruction or guidance at school about how to fill out the census, Landon said. The same thing happened to Betzabel Ayala. She was counted in Phoenix because she was living at home after the coronavirus shutdown of colleges around the country. The question of where to count off-campus college students in any census can be difficult. Parents often think their college-age children should be counted with them. Hundreds of thousands of U.S. college students are being counted for the 2020 census at their parents' homes or other places. These students normally live in non-university housing and are supposed to be counted where they go to school. Ames, Iowa is home to Iowa State University. The city has a population of 67,000 people. Officials are worried that if the 2020 census misses the more than 15,000 students who live off campus, it could put the city's population count below 50,000. Some people say the coming undercount could harm college towns across the country. In some places with major universities, students make up as much as 3/4 of the population. Most people received information from the 2020 census in March. That is also when restrictions in much of the U.S. went into effect to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Many schools switched to online classes, causing many students to leave. The Census Bureau says college students should be counted where they would have been on April 1st if not for the health crisis. The Census Bureau sought the help of college administrators in getting lists of students who do not live on campus or have left town. But many universities did not want to take part because of privacy concerns. In addition, off-campus students at many schools are not required to provide information about where they live. A lot of what is provided by the schools is also missing important information, such as birth dates. That is from a report last month by the Office Inspecting the U.S. Census Bureau. The undercount problem, however, involves only students living off campus in non-university housing. The Census Bureau uses records supplied by colleges to count students living in dormitories or university apartments. But off-campus students make up about 4 million of the 19 million college students in the U.S. That number comes from Dudley Poston, a demographer at Texas A&M University. State College, Pennsylvania is home to Penn State University. 25% of students living in one neighborhood there answered the 2020 census either online, by mail, or by phone. Douglas Shantz, a city spokesman, said the current percentage is much lower than the 60% who answered the 2010 census. With less than a month left until the census ends, the city has placed signs all over downtown State College. The city also spent $5,000 mailing out postcard reminders about the census to students who returned for the fall semester to off-campus apartments or fraternity and sorority houses. "We are kind of begging at this point for students to do the right thing," Shantz said. Steve Patterson is the mayor of Athens, Ohio. He said if Ohio University's graduating class of 3,500 students was not counted last spring, the city could lose $49 million in federal funding over 10 years. Across the country, students' answers to census questionnaires will affect how $1.5 trillion in federal money is spent and how many congressional seats each state gets. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Researchers say an ancient wild dog known for making unusual singing noises has been rediscovered after 50 years. Scientists had theorized that the breed called the New Guinea singing dog had likely gone extinct by the 1970s. The dogs are native to the Pacific Ocean island of New Guinea, the second largest island in the world. The western half of New Guinea belongs to Indonesia, while the eastern half makes up the independent country of Papua New Guinea. Researchers say genetic tests have confirmed that the New Guinea singing dog is in fact closely related to wild dogs seen in New Guinea in recent years. That breed is known as the Highland Wild Dog. It is thought to be the rarest and most ancient dog-like animal in existence. The genetic research was recently reported in a study in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It uncovered many genetic similarities when comparing the DNA from the two breeds. Researchers from the National Human Genome Research Institute carried out the study. The institute is part of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, or NIH. Scientists from Indonesia's Cenderawasih University also took part, along with researchers from other educational organizations. The New Guinea singing dog was first studied in 1897. It became known for its ability to make pleasing singing-like sounds. The sounds are unlike any produced by other dog populations. The sounds have been described as a wolf howl with overtones of whale song. Scientists have estimated that only 200 to 300 New Guinea singing dogs currently exist in captivity in zoos and protective centers. Observations of the Highland wild dog are also rare in New Guinea. There had been reports of Highland wild dogs living in an area in Papua New Guinea in 2009, the study noted. But there were only two known cases of Highland wild dogs being seen and photographed up until 2016. The New Guinea singing dog that we know of today is a breed that was basically created by people, said Elaine Ostrander in a statement. She is an NIH investigator and lead writer of the study. Eight were brought to the United States from the highlands of New Guinea and bred with each other to create this group. Many researchers had suggested that the Highland wild dog might have been the predecessor to New Guinea singing dogs. But the lack of sightings and genetic information on Highland wild dogs made it difficult to test this theory. But in 2016, researchers led a trip to a rural mountain area in Papua, Indonesia. The group found 15 Highland wild dogs near the Grasberg mine, the largest gold mine in the world. A follow-up visit in 2018 permitted researchers to collect blood samples from three Highland wild dogs. The samples were examined and compared with DNA from captive New Guinea singing dogs. Heidi Parker is a scientist with the National Human Genome Research Institute. She said in a statement that the comparisons showed the two breeds had very similar genetic sequences, much closer to each other than any other dog-like animals. The researchers noted that the genetic sequences of the two dogs are not exactly the same. This is likely because of physical separation and continued inbreeding over many years among New Guinea singing dogs. However, the researchers stated that since the two share such a large number of genetic similarities, they are, in essence, the same breed. This finding proves that the New Guinea singing dog population is not extinct in the wild, the researchers added. The research team says it hopes to start breeding efforts between Highland wild dogs and New Guinea singing dogs in captivity to help create a true New Guinea singing dog population. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. We've been discussing the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. He was America's third president, elected in 1800. In our last program, we talked about the dispute between Jefferson and the Chief Justice of the United States. Jefferson believed the Constitution gave Congress the right to decide the country's laws. But Chief Justice John Marshall believed the Supreme Court had the final say. The two men's beliefs were tested in a case called Marbury versus Madison. John Marshall's arguments won. He wrote a decision saying the Supreme Court had the power to rule on the laws that Congress passed. The Supreme Court did not act on that power during Jefferson's administration. But John Marshall's decision did help establish the role of the Supreme Court in the American government. The Marbury versus Madison case is one of the important legacies of Jefferson's presidency. But historian Joseph Ellis says it was not the only one.
The major achievement of Jefferson's presidency is the Louisiana Purchase, which is a lot of luck, as well as his willingness to take advantage of the luck.
The story of the Louisiana Purchase begins with France and Spain. The two European countries wanted to limit the power of the United States. So in 1800, Spain and France entered into a secret treaty. In the treaty, Spain gave France control of a large area in North America called the Louisiana Territory. The Louisiana Territory stretched north to south from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada, and it stretched east to west from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. The area was important not only for its large size, it also included some valuable navigation features, including where the Mississippi River opened into the Gulf of Mexico. Napoleon Bonaparte ruled France at that time. Jefferson did not want Napoleon in North America. He felt the French presence was a threat to the peace of the United States. He decided to try to buy parts of the Louisiana Territory, especially around the mouth of the Mississippi River near the city of New Orleans. Jefferson sent James Monroe to Paris as a special negotiator. But Monroe never had a chance to offer the American position. Napoleon had decided to sell everything to the Americans. He told his finance minister to give up Louisiana, all of it. Napoleon needed money for a war with Britain. James Monroe was happy to negotiate the purchase of Louisiana. They agreed on a price of 80 million francs for all the land drained by the Great Mississippi River and all its many streams. The Louisiana Purchase nearly doubled the size of the United States at that time. It included the present-day states of Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. It stretched into parts of Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Louisiana. The Louisiana Purchase also opened the Mississippi River to American commerce and travel. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says that as a result of this access, the Louisiana Purchase fueled the country's economic expansion in the 19th century. And Mr. O'Shaughnessy says the Louisiana Purchase created more opportunities for Americans to own land.
It was very important to Jefferson because he really wanted every free member of society to be able to own land. He regarded land ownership as, in many ways, essential to someone's independence and their ability, therefore, to participate in a republican government.
But both Mr. O'Shaughnessy and historian Joseph Ellis say the Louisiana Purchase went against Jefferson's beliefs about central government. Joseph Ellis says that in many ways, Jefferson's presidency aimed to make the federal government almost invisible and to limit the president's power.
And the Louisiana Purchase is the most authoritative executive action in American presidential history. One president decides to buy the Midwest, and he does it unilaterally.
Historians say the Louisiana Purchase is one example of Jefferson's contradictory character, in which he says one thing but does another. Andrew O'Shaughnessy adds that Jefferson made trade-offs. When he bought Louisiana, Jefferson used presidential power in a way that was not specifically permitted by the Constitution. But Mr. O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was also looking to the higher good. In the case of the Louisiana Purchase, the good of improving the country's political health. Federalists in the early 1800s also questioned Jefferson's decision to buy Louisiana. They feared it would weaken the power of the states of the Northeast. Federalist leaders made a plan to form a new government of those states. But to succeed, they needed the state of New York. Their plan for a new government led to another memorable episode in American history. Aaron Burr was vice president during Thomas Jefferson's first term. Burr became a candidate for New York governor. The Federalists believed Burr would win the election, become governor, and support their plan. But Federalist leader Alexander Hamilton did not trust Burr. The two had been enemies for a long time. Hamilton made some strong statements against Burr during the election campaign in New York. The comments later appeared in several newspapers. Burr lost the New York election. The Federalist plan for a new government of northeastern states died. New York historian Valerie Paley says Burr heard about Hamilton's strong comments. He was offended.
He called him something like despicable. It hinged on a word, one word, and a word as simple as despicable.
Burr asked Hamilton to admit or deny the comments. Hamilton refused. The two men exchanged more notes. Burr was not satisfied with Hamilton's answers. He believed Hamilton had attacked his honor. Burr demanded a duel. A duel is a fight, usually with guns. Valerie Paley says, in those days, gentlemen often used duels to settle rivalries and defend their honor.
So it wasn't so much these men dueled to kill. They would purposely miss their shots, and then everything, the air would be cleared.
Hamilton opposed duels, yet he agreed to fight Burr on July 11th, 1804. The two men met at Weehawken, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from New York City. The duel would take place by the water's edge at the bottom of a high rock wall. The guns were loaded. Burr and Hamilton took their places. One of Hamilton's friends explained the rules. "Are you ready, gentlemen?" he asked. Both answered yes. There was a moment of silence. He gave the signal. Burr and Hamilton raised their guns. Two shots split the air. Hamilton raised up on his toes. then fell to the ground. Burr remained standing. He looked at Hamilton with regret, then left. Hamilton died the next day. He was not yet 50. Valerie Paley says Hamilton's story is almost like a television or newspaper drama.
He was extremely attractive, and he had such a romantic story. Here he is, the immigrant boy from the West Indies, made good, comes to New York, goes to King's College, becomes a self-taught lawyer, becomes aide de camp to Washington, all sorts of extraordinary things, marries so well, and also has this vision of what modern America might become, and in many ways was able to implement at least an early bit of that vision before his death.
Hamilton had made a big impact on the United States. He had created a national bank and influenced many government policies. Newspapers throughout the nation reported his death. Most people accepted the news calmly. To them, it was simply the sad end to an old private dispute. In the months after Hamilton's death, the nation prepared for the next presidential election. Once again, the Republican Party chose Thomas Jefferson as its candidate for president. But the Republicans refused to support Aaron Burr for vice president again. Instead, they chose George Clinton. Clinton had served as governor of New York 7 times. The Federalist Party chose Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina as its candidate for president. It chose Rufus King of New York to be its vice presidential candidate. The campaign was quiet. In those days, candidates did not make many speeches. Republican pamphlets told of the progress made during the past 4 years. The former Federalist administration raised taxes, they said. Jefferson ended many of the taxes. The Federalists borrowed millions of dollars. Jefferson borrowed none. And Jefferson got the Louisiana Territory without going to war. The Federalists could not dispute these facts. They expected that Jefferson would be reelected, but they were sure their candidate would get as many as 40 electoral votes. The results shocked the Federalists. Jefferson received 162 electoral votes. Pinckney received just 14. One man tried to explain the meaning of Jefferson's great victory. He was John Quincy Adams, son of former President John Adams. President Adams had been a firm Federalist. This is what his son said. "The power of Jefferson's administration rests on a strong majority of the American people. The president has great popular support. His re-election shows that the experiment of the Federalists has failed. It never can and never will be brought to life again. To try to bring it back would be foolish. It would be like trying to put life into a body that has been buried for years." After the election of 1804, only 7 Federalists remained in the United States Senate. Only 25 remained in the House of Representatives. Thomas Jefferson would be president for another 4 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.